Welcome everyone to the May 2nd, 2011 Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, and Economic Development. We're going to start out with House Bill 2238 because I think we got a bunch of people are here to talk on that. So go ahead. Richard?
2238 establishes that a person who owns small woodland of less than 5,000 acres may register a motor vehicle that has a gross vehicle rating of 26,000 pounds or less as a farm vehicle. There's a revenue impact statement and minimal fiscal, and there is a subsequent referral to the Finance and Revenue Committee.
Okay. Roger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer here, representing Oregon Small Woodlands Association. I may ask Frank Pender and Mike to come up with me. I'm just here to introduce some real people who came in today to talk about this bill. It's an important bill for small woodland owners. As you've already heard, the general specifics of the bill would be that small woodland owners of less than 5,000 acres would be available to get a farm plate for their vehicles, providing they meet the other specifications of farm plate, which are, and I will quote it right out of the bill, that they raise products in sufficient quantities to reasonably require the use of a motor vehicle or vehicles for which the registration is sought. So it's not a wide open exemption. Someone with 2 acres would probably never qualify, but someone with more acreage than that certainly would be able to use that this tool. I'd like to introduce my members who are here to talk about how it would affect them, and hopefully after that you will ask questions if you have them and then move the bill to the Revenue Committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Register.
Thank you, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Mike Barnes. I'm a family forest landowner in Yamhill in Washington counties, and also served as a consulting forester for over 30 years, clients, many family forest landowner clients in Northwest Oregon. I've owned the piece of property where I reside since 1980, and I continue to face pressures that make economic returns from the harvest of forest products more and more difficult. My home place consists of 60 acres of forested land located on Parrot Mountain, which is close to Newburgh, Wilsonville, and Sherwood, all of which have seen significant population growth in recent years. And this pressure to convert land to a higher and better use will increase as the years come. But it is my home, and it is where I raised my family. And I intend to keep tree farming as long as I can and show my grandchildren that forestry and the production of forest products is still possible in this state. I own a small portable sawmill and sell finished products and firewood from the lower quality logs from that land. The truck I use for this operation is an older 1987 diesel Ford pickup. The truck is used for less than 1,000 miles per year, primarily for the transport of these minor forest products. The ability to use this truck under farm registration process would allow me to reduce my costs and keep this activity going. I'm not speaking of a great economic benefit or a large loss of registration revenue to the state, just a small incentive that indicates that the state of Oregon supports the retention of small business entities like mine. This type of support is provided to farmers of this state, and I consider my activities to be a growing of a crop also. It just takes me 50-plus years to bring my crop to maturity. So I would urge you to demonstrate your support of dedicated tree farmers like me by supporting the passage of this legislation. Thank you for your consideration.
Chairman Beyer and committee, my name is Frank Pender. I operate a 75 to 80 acre parcel of timber ground outside the city of Dallas up on Pioneer Road. I have a small sawmill operation similar to Mr. Barnes. I've been operating my mill for about 20 years now. I also have a kiln, so I custom cut lumber for people. I have an F-450 Ford. It's a little bit bigger than a standard pickup. And there's some inequities here with this. I remember when the legislation was presented a number of years ago dealing with the wheat farmers that started in northeastern Oregon wanting to haul their own commodities. Well, ours is a commodity, too. And like Mr. Barnes said, it's a cycle that's, for some of us, it's 25 to 50 to 75 years. The big timber boys, they're looking at about a 35 to 40-year cycle on their trees. I have a neighbor friend that has timber ground to approximately 200 acres of ground, and some of it is hay ground. He just bought a F-550, for example. His license on his truck for his farm plate, because he raises some hay, maybe, 60 ton a year at the most, is $99. Mine is $535, comparable vehicle size. Now, there's about $400 difference here. And that's, to me, that's a lot of money for a one-man business, and I can put that into other entities of my farm products or my tree farm products. And it isn't just trees we produce now. Some of us are growing some products like Scotch broom. Whoa, I got an attention over here, and a couple other eyes lit up here. Now, I know I know what it's listed as and so on, but it makes one of the best carving woods I've ever found for walking sticks and canes. Hmm. Okay? Hazelnuts and those kinds of commodities. And I use my vehicle, my truck, my 450, for moving those kinds of products. Ferns and all kinds of things like that are also available for small woodlot owners. So for me, it's a real financial benefit. You know, I can't afford to pay $525 or $30 at one whack. I have to buy it on a quarterly basis, my license. And then that costs a little bit more money, buying it on a quarterly basis. So I don't have a cash flow to handle that large amount. So for me, it would be a benefit, and many other small woodlot owners, if we could see our way into having this bill come to fruition. I pushed for something like this to occur about 18 years ago or 20 years ago, and all of a sudden I got a call a few weeks back, would you come and testify in the House? I got a call on Thursday morning at 10 o'clock, and the meeting was at 3. I didn't even know there was a bill out like that. I'd given up. Okay, and I'm excited about this, and I think it would be a benefit for all of us that have a commodity like we do in the timber industry, and helps the small woodlot owner get through some of their tough economic times. I'm open to questions also, if you have some questions.
Does anyone have any questions?
Thank you.
Go ahead, Bart.
One question, the 5,000 limit there, is there a reason why 5,000 was chosen and why is a cap at all? What's the difference between a 10,000 acre property?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Berger, there is a reason 5,000 acres was chosen. It may not specifically address this bill, but for Department of Revenue purposes, in statute, tree farms of less than 5,000 acres are considered a small tree farm versus larger than that don't qualify to be a small woodland owner tree farm. So we adopted that acreage because that is already current with revenue statutes. Does it matter as far as economically, should it be that capped at that? I can't answer that question. I'm sure there are people with 5,010 acres who would love to be able to have this exemption for them, but we had to pick a number somewhere.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you for your time.
How about Jim Brown, Neil Schroeder, and Jim James? Whoever wants to start.
You guys go ahead. I'll finish up.
I get to start.
Okay, I'm Jim Brown. I'm the president of the Washington County Small Woodlands Association. We have about 195 members, and woodlands from anything from 10 acres up to several hundred acres. This bill would benefit those folks who haul firewood, that sort of thing. These vehicles hit the road a few times a year. A lot of people put less than 1,000 miles on them. And in some cases, with the larger vehicles, they're having to spend several hundred dollars for a license rather than what the farm rates would, you know, what they would allow. We think it's kind of, as stated before, sort of an equity situation with small farmers. similar situation and similar vehicles, really.
Good. That's it.
I'm Neil Schroeder. I am the president of the Oregon Woodland Cooperative. We are approximately 60 to 66 members, representing about 26,000 acres of land here in Oregon, in about 16 counties. And of those members, probably at least half of them would fit into this category where they need some relief in some form or another. And just to give you some idea of what the Oregon Woodland Cooperative is all about, we are in the business of trying to make a profit from our woodlands. And when you look at a 60-year rotation, that isn't always easy. And one of the things we're doing right now is developing as much as we can for non-timber forest products. And that takes a lot of experimentation and trial. And there are a lot of interesting things that we're doing. We hope that it'll be a economical, viable activity that'll really help the woodland situation in Oregon. Hope so any help you can give us would be most appreciated.
Hope you're not growing a lot of scotch broom.
Believe it or not, we are.
Say that. I'm on the legislative committee.
We're not raising it, but you know, you can extract the oil from scotch broom, and surprisingly, it has a medicinal value. It's really interesting. Jim James.
Thank you. Chairman Byer and rest of the committee, thank you for being here today. My name is Jim James. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. And just for the record, I would like to say a lot of our members eradicate the scotch broom on their property. OSWA has over 3,000 members, and I'm here representing them plus other small woodland owners in our state. And our perception is that this bill will not have a huge revenue impact on the state, very minuscule. But it has the potential for a great revenue impact for small woodland owners, and in turn then would benefit the state. And so it is our feeling that this is a positive direction for the state to take to allow small woodland owners to have the same abilities that farmers have, to have plates that allow them to haul their product to market. I left with a handout a copy of one of OSWA's quarterly publications called Northwest Woodlands, and it focuses on secondary wood products, and you'd be amazed how many secondary wood products there are coming from our forest today. And again, having those farm plates would allow our members and other small woodland owners to benefit and be able to help them and assist them to get those products to market. I had a few more things to say, but basically I'd just be repeating what you've already heard, so I will close and ask you to please support House Bill 2238A. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Questions to this panel? You got off easy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Russell.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell. I'm with the Oregon Log Truck Association, which is a part of the Oregon Trucking Associations today, and I'm here in support of House Bill 2238. I want to thank the members of the Small Woodlands Association and Mr. Byer, their executive director, for working with us and being willing to modify the bill to address all of our concerns. So I'm here in support, and that's all I have to say.
It's a fairly small truck that we're talking about.
It is now.
It's a commercial.
Yes. 26,000 pounds and less. And we changed the length of the log that they can haul to up to 17 feet, which makes sense. Roger explained it to me, but I don't remember the term. Trim. For trim purposes, to add the additional length to the log makes absolute sense, so we're perfectly fine.
What's the length of a log truck?
A log truck normally hauls logs much larger than that, and we're 80,000 pounds minimum.
Questions? No. Thank you much, Bob. Anybody else who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing and we will open the work session on House Bill 2238. Shall I move? Would you like to move the bill?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move House Bill 2238 to the Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Girard has moved House Bill 2238A to the Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. No discussion. Is there any opposition? Seeing none, House Bill 2238A is moved to the Revenue Committee with the due pass recommendation by unanimous vote of the committee. So we'll adjourn the work session on House Bill 2238 and we will open on House Bill 2136.
Richard. House Bill 2136 provides the Oregon Department of Transportation rulemaking authority to electronically accept fuel taxes. There is no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact.
Don't be shy. Whenever you're ready.
Chair Byer, members of the committee, my name is Maureen Bach, and I'm the Fuels Tax Group Manager for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'm here today to testify on House Bill 2136. We have provided written testimony, and I'll just summarize it for your benefit. The written testimony has a number of attachments, including a list of the fuels tax programs that we administer at ODOT on behalf of local jurisdictions, an overview of the program itself, explaining that we collect on average about $41 million a month in the program. That includes both the gas tax, which is collected at first distribution, as well as the diesel tax and the propane tax and the compressed natural gas tax, which is tax collected when those fuels are placed into the fuel tank of a vehicle used on the roads. To collect this, right now we have a paper-based process that results in us receiving about 18,000 pieces of paper every month. So this bill would allow us to change things so the distributors and the people who pay the tax are able to file electronically and alleviate some of the burden of sending us the pieces of paper they currently send us. So if there are any questions, I'm happy to entertain them, but that's a summary of the bill.
Questions of Maureen. Senator Starr.
Thank you. Does it require electronic filing, or does some company somewhere that can't file electronically still file the old-fashioned way?
Senator Starr, members of the committee, that's a good question. This bill does not mandate electronic filing. We intend to work with the licensees. They've actually asked for us to do this, and so this is just enabling us to work with them. We currently don't have a system that accepts this electronic filing, so we'll be working with those people.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2136? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing and open work session on House Bill 2136. Chair would move House Bill 2136 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, House Bill 2136 is moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation by unanimous vote. And let's see, we'll close the work session on that. And Senator Starr, would you like to carry this?
Sure.
All right. And I forgot to do a carrier on the last one, but I think that was
revenue.
Huh?
It went to revenue.
It went to revenue. That's right. Don't have to. All right, so we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2137.
Senate Bill 2137 allows the Department of Transportation to cancel a person's driving privileges if the department deems it necessary. There is no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact.
Amy, Joyce?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, representing the DMV, here today on House Bill 2137, which may be the driest bill that you consider this session. It is a cleanup and otherwise dealing with the multiple statutes that deal with suspensions and revocations of the driver license. There are more than 50 ORSs dealing with driving while suspended and driving while revoked in Oregon statute. They create the violation. They tell us how to process the violations, tell DMV how long that will last, and how to reinstate, and on and on and on. Each session, there are amendments that create more violations or deal in some way with the minutia of suspensions, driving while suspended, revocations, and driving while revoked. And over time, DMV identifies things that need to be fixed. And this session, we bring you House Bill 2137. I've handed out some written testimony, and attached to that is a section-by-section analysis of the bill. So I will hit just a couple of the highlights that we have in there. In Section 1, ORS 809280 tells the DMV and the courts variously how to process suspensions. Over time, terms have gotten muddled and additional terms added. So in Section 1, we're just going to consistent language. And on the House side, we worked with the Judicial Department for a small amendment, and the Judicial Department is fine with Section 1 and with the entire bill. Section 13 allows DMV to cancel a driver license immediately in very particular circumstances. Current law allows an immediate suspension if due to medical or mental impairment under a doctor's determination who sends something to DMV, that person should no longer be driving and should have their license suspended. That allows for an immediate suspension, which DMV interprets as a 5-day notice rather than the typical 30-day notice of suspension. So what Section 13 does is that in those very rare cases in which it is determined that a person is a hazard to people and property by driving, but the reason for that is not any kind of mental or medical defect, just effectively they're such a terrible driver that DMV can issue a suspension that goes into an immediate notice. This happens 40 or 50 times a year, so DMV asks for the quicker suspension ability to match up with the quick suspensions for medical and mental impairment. Section 15 would remove SR 22 insurance filings for two suspensions. That's because back in 2003, when the legislature reorganized, broke apart the suspension statutes, this SR 22 filing was inadvertently added, and so the bill would remove that requirement because it was never intended to be part of that. And Section 17, when a person goes to reinstate their driver license after a DUII conviction, a person has to install an ignition interlock device for either 1 or 2 years, depending on how many convictions they've had. There's an exemption for a person driving an employer's vehicle, subject to multiple restrictions. Back in 2007, when the legislature changed the time of that ignition interlock requirement to 1 or 2 years, as opposed to the old 6 months, this exemption was not updated to correspond to that 1 and 2 year time limit, so it remains that 6-month time period. So this bill would marry up those that time period for this exemption to 1 and 2 years. So those are the highlights of 2137, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So, Amy, back to Section 13.
Yeah. Sure.
Is effectively the difference here the difference between 5 days notice and 30-day notice?
Chair Beyer, that's correct.
Except it appears, if I'm reading this correctly, except you still have a 5-day notice for medical or mental impairment.
Chair Beyer, under current law, it allows for an immediate suspension for the medical or mental impairment, which DMV interprets as 5 days. So the bill simply adds in that for this other type of suspension for non-medical or mental impairment, that
so
what would be the difference? I mean, what kinds of threats are we talking about if it's not medical or mental?
Chair Beyer, again, this happens maybe 40 or 50 times a year. And typically how this would happen is a police officer perhaps would pull over an individual that maybe they thought was driving under the influence. And after stopping them and checking in with them, they're in fact not under the influence. They're just a very bad driver. The officer can use a form to send in to DMV and say, really, DMV, you should be retesting this person. So DMV would take this individual if they come in within the 60 days and retest them. And we have incidences, quite rarely, but that happen where the DMV testing person has to take action to avoid an accident during the test, or the other driver has to take action to avoid an accident. It's that kind of thing happening. What the OAR provides for is repeated testing. We can ask them to go out and take private driving lessons to, you know, improve their skills. But at some point, there comes a determination that this person is quite simply a hazard on the road. So that's that kind of suspension.
So under the current rule of the police, if DMV got one of those notices, they would notify the person that they need to come in to take a test?
Yes.
And they wouldn't issue a suspension until after they did the test?
Chair Beyer, that's correct.
So this would put it first and say, we can suspend you, but you can come in for a test?
Chair Beyer, no, actually they still have those driving privileges for that 60 days till they come in to take the test. Once they take the test, and let's say the driving tester has to take action to keep an accident from happening, today we have to give a 30-day notice before we can suspend their driving privileges. We're asking that it be made an immediate, what we interpret to be a 5-day notice to suspend. So it's police officer tells them to come in for the test. Let's say 45 days later they show up to take that test. Some terrible things happen, and perhaps repeatedly happen. Then at that point, DMV says, okay, we're going to suspend. And today we have to give them that additional 30 days notice before we can suspend. So we're asking for the quicker time period.
Back, make sure I understand this. So if you got a report from a police officer today, you would notify the person and say, you need to come in for a driver's test?
Chair Beyer, that's correct.
You wouldn't issue a 5-day suspension notice?
That's right.
Then you'd call them in, and then if they failed the test, then you could give them a 5-day notice.
Chair Beyer, that's correct.
Okay. Senator Girard.
I'm going to follow up a little bit on the chair's question. The first question has to do with some of the medical problems that the physician. And it's not in the bill, and I can't find where it's clear. What happens if you have opposing points of view from professionals? One says they are capable of driving, and one says they're not.
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, if I can clarify, are we talking now about the medical or mental impairment situation,
right,
which is the at-risk driver program for DMV? So typically what would happen is the person's own physician would be sending in this notice to DMV saying, you know, Mr. Smith shouldn't be driving anymore. And then DMV employs medical determination officers, MDOs, who are physicians, who review medical records to determine what their in their judgment, what the appropriate outcome is. They have pages and pages and pages of administrative rules and guidelines about conditions and symptoms. And Oregon's at-risk driver program actually is fairly unique in that there are not set diagnoses where if you're diagnosed with X, we will suspend. That's not how it works here, nor is there any kind of age limit. The standard in Oregon is if there are the kinds of symptoms, I don't have the language in front of me, but the symptoms and the persistence of them, that indicates that the person should no longer be driving, not merely a, for instance, a diagnosis of epilepsy.
Let me give you an example, because it sounds like you have it all outlined, and we'll use epilepsy as an example. Physician writes in that because of uncontrolled epilepsy, I would recommend that the driver's license be suspended, but I'm referring him to a specialist. Specialist, after a while, gets things more in control, and say he writes a letter saying that he thinks that their driver's license should be reinstated. So then the administrative rules would determine who would have priority, which physician would have priority, and I would assume that the driver's license would be reinstated.
Chair Beyer and Senator Girard, right, that medical determination officer then would be looking at those records and making that decision in their best medical judgment and based on extensive criteria about whether that person should be suspended or should not be suspended.
Okay. One final question.
Follow-up.
This is a follow-up again, and it has to do with the bad drivers. Generally speaking, we're talking about the aged in that category.
Chair Beyer and Senator Girard, I do not know who among those 40 or 50 people a year who we're talking about in terms of age or anything else. I can't say.
One last question. If you got the forms, would you send them to me? I've seen quite a few. I'd like to hand them out.
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, I'd be happy to deliver those. Thank you.
Other questions? Senator Starr.
Thank you. So the cancellation occurs for 5 days. Then the individual has the opportunity to go to a hearing after the cancellation.
Chair Beyer, Senator Starr.
They argue to get their driver's license back.
That's correct.
All right.
More?
No question.
Senator Atkinson.
How many licenses do you revoke now a year?
Chair Beyer, Senator Atkinson, the total number, I don't know. I would have to get that for you, but 40 or 50 people a year fall under this specific situation we've been discussing.
And it just takes one complaint to put their license in jeopardy?
Chair Beyer, Senator Atkinson, the standard is, let's see here, may endanger people or property if the person's driving privileges are not immediately canceled. The situations that the DMV personnel have described to me have involved multiple retesting opportunities, a request for people to go out and take private driving lessons to try to improve their skills. So this has not in practice been any kind of instantaneous, you changed lanes inappropriately situation. These are people who have significant problems operating a motor vehicle.
Why don't you stay there? And Gail Meyer?
Thank you, Chair Byers, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I would like to focus my comments to Section 13 and the post-suspension hearing provisions there. As the bill is drafted, it's not limited to just an instance where there's a retesting procedure that's ongoing. I understand Ms. Joyce's comments to be that very frequently an officer would ticket someone and then make think or be concerned this driver's a danger and would send a notice to DMV and they would get that person in for retesting. But as drafted, the bill is not limited to that. It would be, as drafted, something where an officer could ticket someone, an officer could be concerned that they constitute a danger, they could send a notice over to the department, and the department could simply cancel the license based on that. And that's the concern we have, that as drafted, it's not tethered to something that's more grounded in facts of record. So we would like to work with the department if what they're trying to do is address the instance where the hazardous driving occurs during the course of the retesting procedures. That's a different bill. That's not the bill that's drafted. And so Our concern is that the standard is rather standardless, may endanger people or property. That could constitute a huge swath. It could be careless driving. And under our current statutes, you don't automatically lose your license based on a careless driving. So I don't know if we can agree to any language here, but I certainly want to be express to the committee. We're certainly very interested in working with the department if what they're trying to do is limit this bill to hazardous driving that occurs during a retesting procedure. That's a different bill.
Even if we could agree to language here, we'd still have to get it drafted.
Yeah.
Questions? Senator Stark.
I don't have a question, but I have the same issues, I think, that have just been raised. This seems to be overly broad, so I would welcome the opportunity to narrow it up a bit.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I would comment that I'm fine with the underlying concept of moving the notice to 5 days, but if indeed, and I'm reading the language, if indeed there are not sideboards on it, I am not comfortable with not having those sideboards on it.
Okay. Others?
No, I would concur.
You too.
All righty. Sounds like that. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2137? Don't see anyone. So, Amy, it sounds like the committee would like you to work with Ms. Meyer and maybe come up with a little bit tighter sideboards on that.
Chair Byer, understood.
Okay. Thank you very much. So we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3137, and we will open a hearing on this bill.
2138.
House Bill 2138. Richard.
House Bill 2138A requires all commercial driver's license holders to maintain proof of medical qualification on file with the department, with the DMV. There is no revenue impact, but there is a fiscal impact that's been issued, but the House committee did not send it to Ways and Means, and I couldn't get a hold of the fiscal analyst to discuss why it wasn't referred to Ways and Means.
Okay. Let's see. Amy, you're up on this one, too? 2138? Bob, why don't you come on up as well?
Chair Byer, members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, here today with House Bill 2138 having to do with federal compliance with commercial driver license requirements. Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration sets federal regulations on the safety of commercial motor vehicles and drivers holding a commercial driver license or CDL. Those regulations are constantly being updated and changed, and under threat of loss of certain highway fundings and other dollars that come to the state must comply with those federal regulations, which means that nearly every session we come to you asking for minor updates. So this session is House Bill 2138, which primarily has to do with medical certifications for CDL holders. So under current law, with Oregon's 8-year license renewal, a person with a CDL would show their medical certification for CDL issuance at issuance, and then 8 years later at renewal. But the relatively new federal regulation says that at least every 2 years, the CDL holder must demonstrate that medical certification. So the bill would allow DMV to require folks to show their medical certification at least every 2 years, more frequently if the doctor will only issue a person, for instance, a 6-month certification. And folks will be able to mail in that certification. They don't have to come and stand in line at the DMV. Another federal compliance piece has to do with the timing of suspensions for various traffic offenses. Some CDL suspensions are based on the number of convictions that a driver has over a period of time. Current law runs that time period from conviction date to conviction date. The federal law requires it to run from offense date to offense date, so we ask that in this bill that be changed. Mm-hmm. And the bill also makes clear that if a CDL holder submits false information during those intervening periods between the 8-year issuance and renewal for the medical certification, that kind of false submission can subject a person to a suspended license. That's the bulk of the bill, and I'd take any questions that you have.
Ooh, go ahead, Bob.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. We're here to support this bill. It is absolutely required under federal law. We're moving to integrate the medical card that we've carried forever with the CDL, which makes a lot of sense. This is the first step in doing that, along with a number of other little adjustments that need to be made because they've changed the rules at the federal level, and that means we have to change the rules here.
Amy, do you know about the fiscal?
Chair Beyer, there is a hefty fiscal on it. The department has a policy option package down in Ways and Means to address that, so that's why I understood that it was not sent, that the bill itself was not sent down to Ways and Means.
I think it has to go down there.
I would think so, too. You pass it, and
the
don't pass
package
it
is down there. It's a good way to get your option package approved. Let's see. Any questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2138? Seeing none, I think this has to go to fiscal, or Ways and Means.
I don't know why it wouldn't.
Huh?
I don't know why we sent it there, Senate President, and tell us we had to.
Other than apparently it has a really big fiscal,
it might encourage
getting the option package out.
Yeah, it's up to you. I think you're probably correct. It does have, I mean, what, $500,000?
Is that what it was, $500,000?
It also says that they've gotten $600,000 in federal grant funds to...
Why don't we sit on it for a day and
find out?
I like the relating clause, Mr. Chair.
You what?
I like the relating clause.
That's a lot of purpose. That's just a willy nilly send down.
You guys are really liking the relating clauses today. All righty. I think we will close on this, and will you check on that, please?
I'll talk to the people.
So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2138. And we'll open on House Bill 2156, public hearing.
Richard. Senate Bill 2156 clarifies that a licensed landscape contracting business's surety bond covers backflow assembly, testing service, insulation repair, or maintenance of backflow assemblies for irrigation systems, ornamental water features, and irrigation control wiring and outdoor landscaping lighting. There's no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact.
Okay. Gentlemen.
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, my name for the record is Mike Snyder. I am the administrator for your Landscape Contractors Board of the State of Oregon. I thank you for taking time to hear these. We have three bills in front of you today. This is House Bill 2156. 2156 has been amended, and now the current bill is basically a housekeeping bill for us. The law currently allows licensed landscape contracting businesses to install backflows and to repair backflows, to test backflows. And the law also allows landscape contracting businesses to have exemptions from the electrical board to install low voltage wiring for landscape lighting and irrigation control. When they gave us those exemptions, they didn't make any provision in our statutes to allow the consumer to access our bond, the landscape contracting business bond, if they did perform that work. So this bill makes that access to the bond for the consumer to have that in case they do some negligent work. So that's what this bill does. I'll answer any questions that you have.
Any questions, Mike? Senator Starr?
Thank you. So can you tell me how many complaints you've had this year related to this issue that
why this consumer protection is necessary?
In terms of backflow, we probably only had three complaints about backflow issues. Low voltage wiring, we had none.
So three complaints?
Yes.
Anybody else? Thank you.
Chairman Byer, members of the committee, my name is John Galista. I own a company called Professional Grounds Management based in Portland. I was president of OLCA, the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association, in 2005, and I currently serve as the legislative chair. I've had an opportunity with my committee and both the state OLCA board to discuss this issue, and we ask for your support on its behalf. I personally thought that these two issues were covered under the bond, and is just it's an avenue to provide consumer protection, which should be there.
Any questions from John?
Just for the both of them, is this going to increase the cost of the bond in any way, shape, or form to the contractors?
Senator Starr and Chair Byer, no, this does not.
Mr. Chair, follow up. Is this going to provide a hurdle or a barrier to anybody that wants to get into the landscape contracting business?
Senator Starr, Chair Byer, no.
Okay. Anybody else? Seeing none. Thank you, gentlemen. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on 2156? You can just stay there. I think we got more for you, right?
Okay.
Before no one else on 2156, close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2156A. Anybody want to offer a motion?
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2156A to the floor with a two-pass recommendation.
Senator Edwards has moved House Bill 2156A to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none?
I think I share some concern. Well, where Senator Starr wasn't saying what his concerns were, but I imagine by his line of questioning that perhaps he has some of the concerns that I do, that regulations coming through this board are making it more difficult to become a licensed contractor, a landscape contractor in the state of Oregon. I generally have looked at those type of measures with a wary eye, but I don't see that this bill does that, and we'll support the measure.
Okay. Anybody else? Seeing none, is there opposition? No opposition?
There's skepticism.
Skepticism, but no opposition. I take that as a unanimous vote to move House Bill 2156A to the floor with the due-pass recommendation. We'll close the work session on that. And Senator Edwards, would you carry this?
Sure.
Okay. So we'll now open on public hearing on House Bill 2157.
Chairman Byer and members of the committee, again, my name is Mike Snyder.
Excuse me, Mike. Let's let Richard first.
Senate Bill 2157 requires an applicant for a landscaping contracting business license that is registered as a non-exempt independent contractor to provide workers' compensation insurance coverage. There's no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact.
Now.
Thank you. Chairman Byer and members of the committee, my name is Mike Snyder, Administrator for the Landscape Contractors Board. House Bill 2157 deals with the independent contractor issue and how businesses register with the board. Currently, the law requires that every landscape contracting business register with the board either as exempt, which means they don't have employees, or as non-exempt, which means that they are going to have employees. When they become a licensed landscape contracting business, they have to follow the workers' comp law plus all the employment laws, etc. Current workers' comp law does not require all businesses to carry workers' comp on their employees. There's a certain threshold that has to be met in order for that workers' comp coverage to go into effect. we feel like every landscape contracting business that does register with us as non-exempt should have a policy for workers' comp coverage because they're going to have workers on the job site. We currently have businesses, we've had several cases where businesses are out on the job site, registered as non-exempt with us, and they don't have workers' comp, and they have employees on the job site. They tell us at that time that these employees are day workers. They're paying them less than $500 in a month. They're paying them cash. And we feel like that the consumer is unwary of the risk that they're taking by having these employees on their job site without that coverage. The bill also requires a company that registers as exempt with us, means they don't have employees, they have that option, those businesses have the option to go to a temporary labor provider or leasing company to lease those employees to the business. We have, our bill would ask them to notify the board before these employees are put on the job site that they have workers' comp for those employees. So that's basically what the bill does.
Senator Atkinson.
How is, you said in your statement that this is a consumers are unaware of their risk. How is this the consumer's risk?
When there's employees on the job site and there's no workers' comp coverage, there's a possibility that that employee could be injured. And if the business does not have that coverage, the homeowner could possibly pay for some of that injury.
Through what policy?
Through the homeowner's policy.
Has that happened before?
It has occurred, not with us necessarily, but it's a risk that the we feel like is not necessary for the homeowner to have.
He can be sued. Senator Starr.
Thank you. So for the most part, I'm fine with this bill, except for the part where you are telling the licensee that they have to tell you if they have if they've gone outside to a lease, an employee leasing agency, that then they have to circle back with you. I don't think that that's necessary. Is that required if you're a construction contractor that you have to if that you have leased employees that you have to notify the CCB?
I don't know if that's a requirement for
that. No, it's not because I was this former contractor. I did that and I never had to tell the CCB anything. I was a exempt contractor and when I needed employees, I went to a leasing company to get them. That just creates, in my opinion, an additional hurdle for a landscape contractor to have to circle back. It might be a temporary job, 2 or 3 days, where they're, you know, doing a big install that normally they don't have to do, and it's just another box that they're going to have to check to circle back, and more bureaucracy that they're going to have to follow up with. It creates an opportunity for an enforcement action from the Landscape Contractors Board that is unnecessary and a hurdle for a private company that I don't think that it's necessary. And it seems to me that the Workers' Compensation Division is the one that would be would be regulating private business workers' comp issues as well. So I understand the exempt, non-exempt piece as it relates to the Landscape Contractors Board. It's just this whole leasing thing doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Can you try to sure. make it make sense to me?
I'll do my best, Senator Starr, Chair Beyer. One of the issues we have when we go onto a job site is we find employees on a job site that are working, doing landscaping work, and we ask them to who they're working for, and they say they're working for Joe Smith, Landscape Contracting Business. We look, check on our records, and we find that this business is exempt. And that means they don't have employees. And so we ask the people, okay, who's paying you? Well, Joe Smith is paying us. Okay, how is he paying you? Well, he pays me by cash. And so we say to Joe Smith, we say, where is the workers' comp coverage? Well, I have them with leasing company ABC.
Well, by the time we be able to get back to the office and verify all the information about leasing company ABC, we have found out that Joe Smith has called ABC company and put those people on that payroll because he got caught, and we don't know how long those people have been working for. We could ask them again and say, how long have you been working for Joe Smith? Well, I've been working for him for weeks. Well, that business has been operating without any coverage, and they have the ability to go to that leasing company and get hired on for that day, which gets them in compliance for that period. But they should have had that workers' comp before. And so we're saying that they're doing landscaping work, and they're going to have these leasing companies, all they have to do is provide us a certificate of insurance that says that they have workers' comp from that leasing company, and they're good to go. And so it's like an insurance for us to say, we're giving you a license, you're saying you're exempt, the coverage is there. And then we go to the job site, and they have those employees, we know that those people are covered. And we know what leasing company they're using. We feel the homeowner has the right to have that protection.
More?
John?
Okay. Chairman Byer, members of the committee, thank you. My name is John Glista. I own Professional Grounds. I'm also the legislative chair for OCA. I'm a non-exempt company. I run 14 employees, and we carry comp on all of our guys. As industry, we ask you to support this bill. We feel it shows that industry is taking the high road and making sure that all the verification steps are in process or there to be verified. I also feel that it's important for the homeowner or my potential client to be able to go online, and when they do my license check, to be able to check and verify that I do have workers' comp coverage on my guys that they can then check and see on the landscape contractor's website. And this bill helps provide that. So,
questions? Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2157? Okay, we'll close the public hearing on 2157, and we'll attempt this. We'll open the work session on 2157A. And does anybody want to move the bill? Mr. Chair.
If I move it, do I have to carry it?
No.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2157A to the floor with the due pass recommendation, more or less.
More or less.
Don't look at me. I'm in the same boat they are. I'm not carrying it either.
Discussion on the motion.
I'm supportive. It appears to me that this will help level the playing field between contractors that have employees and are following all the steps, and contractors who, for lack of a better word, are you know, operating in the gray or black zone and of the market. So I think that's a good thing. I'm suspect about how many protections this really gives to homeowners, but for the other reasons, I'll support the bill.
Let me just ask a question. Is there, for those of you who have doubts, is there amendments that would make you feel more comfortable?
Certainly.
Huh?
Certainly.
Would you like to work on it?
If the chair wants to move a bill without no votes, I'd be willing to entertain an amendment. But yeah, sure.
Would you like me to? I'd like to
withdraw my motion.
I'll withdraw my motion, Mr. Chair.
All righty. So the motion has been withdrawn. So we will close the work session on 2157 and.
You might want to talk to Senator Starr.
We'll do that. Thank you very much.
We'll open on 2158. Open on public hearing on 2158.
Richard. Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 2158 requires an applicant for an initial landscaping contracting business license to have the owner or managing employee trained and examined on subjects of landscaping contracting business practices and related Oregon laws as required by the Landscape Contractors Board administrative rules.
Okay.
There's no revenue and minimal fiscal.
Let's try this one.
Okay. Thank you. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, House Bill 2158. What this bill is attempting to do is to make it easier for an individual to become licensed as a landscape construction professional. Currently, what we have in our law is that every landscape construction professional has to pass a very rigorous exam on the technical aspects of landscaping, plus a section on laws and rules and business practice. That laws and rules and business practice is an exam that not every landscape construction professional really wants to own a business. They just want to be an employee of a licensed landscape contracting business. They want to perform the technical parts of the business and do the direct supervision for the business. This bill allows those people that have just the technical acumen to do the work to pass just the technical sections of the exam. It also lets the board recognize other certifications that are demonstrations of technical ability through the association. There's a very well-known accreditation. It's called the CLT program, that people do a hands-on demonstration of their technical ability. The board, with a slight modification, could accept that in lieu of taking a written exam for that technical part. If that person wants then to own a business, they would take the 16-hour course that's already in place and pass the laws and rules of business section of the exam. So that's what this bill does. Allows there to be more people that can demonstrate their technical ability and not have to have that business acumen that we require today.
John?
Chairman Beyer, members of the committee, thank you. My name is John Galista. I own Professional Grounds, and I'm also the legislative chair for OLCA, the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association. We urge your support of this bill. We feel it will create more sustainable wage positions within the industry, and it will bring more companies into the fold for providing landscape installation services. Both my committee and the state board have had time to discuss this issue, and we feel it's better for the industry. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of clarifying questions. So I'm searching my memory here, and there was, I don't know if it was the last session or the session prior, at least in the House, and I don't know if the bill went all the way through the legislature or not, but there was a bill that would have required the owner, I think, would have required the owner to of a landscape contracting business to pass some sort of test, maybe this test, and I can't remember if it was, if we ended up saying it was the owner or the owner could have somebody designated, and my whole line of questioning was around a big landscape contracting business such as one in Eugene, Grants Landscape, which is owned, I believe, by Rexius. Are they owned by Rexius?
Uh-huh.
And I was just imagining in my mind, really, why would we require Rusty Rexius to have this type of professional license to own this type of business? I mean, it's a large business, a large ongoing concern for years and years. So with that, fill me in on what our current landscape is there, and then how this changes. If I'm understanding this correctly, this would say that licensed professional within that business wouldn't have to have the business practices part of the exam.
Senator Edwards and Chair Beyer, thank you for the question. Currently, the law states this, that a landscape if you're not a licensed landscape construction professional, that means currently the landscape construction professional has passed the laws and rules and business practice section of the exam. They passed all the sections that they are required for their phase of license, demonstrate their minimum competency in those areas. We have three different phases currently. If you're not that person and you want to start a landscape contracting business, say you want to make a lot of money in the state of Oregon, do landscaping, then you as an owner of that business either have to take the business course and pass the laws and rules so that you know what it is that you're entering into when you get into landscape contracting, or you have a designated managing employee that takes that course and manages your landscape part of that business. We have so many businesses out there. I mean, we have one of the strictest laws around contract in the state of Oregon. All landscaping work has to be done according to a written contract, no matter what happens. We have all the laws around employment, all the laws around direct supervision that get these businesses in trouble because they don't know what they're supposed to be doing. So having that course, and we're getting 95% of the people that take that course, they pass that exam. It's an open book exam. And so they are able to demonstrate that they have that business acumen to run that business.
So that's the way it is now?
That's the way it is now. Now, what this bill does, it says that, say you don't want to run a business, you just want to work for grants, landscaping. So you don't want to run a business, you just want to be an employee of a licensed business, be on the payroll, and you want to perform landscaping work without having to be directly supervised by somebody else, then you can take the sections of the exam that are the technical part, or you can demonstrate that competency through another certification that the board has approved. And you are licensed then to perform landscaping work, construction. If then you decide you want to own a business, then you can either take the course, pass the exam, or do the managing employee. You can hire a managing employee to do that.
One follow-up. Mm-hmm. So currently, if this bill were to pass, you could not have a let's see, I know what my question is. I'm working it through as I'm talking here. Okay, so under the current scenario, current law, can you have a licensed landscape professional? Is that the term?
Construction professional.
A landscape construction professional working under the supervision of somebody with the same or with that designation, but doing landscape work and not be licensed. I guess that's what I'm trying to determine is, can you have somebody, as long as you have one person that's designated the licensed professional in the company supervising other people that want to be doing similar work, can they be doing that currently under current law? And then how would that change under what I'm hearing is that would not be allowed under the new law?
No, that's not correct.
Okay.
So, Senator, let me try to back up because it is a little bit confusing and complicated to a certain extent. The landscape construction professional, what we're trying to do is make that landscape construction professional only responsible for the technical areas of landscaping. Mm-hmm. If you're not licensed, and say you wanted to go work for John Galista here, and you weren't licensed, John would have to, he's a licensed landscape construction professional, and he's licensed to say he was in irrigation only. If you were performing irrigation work, John would have to directly supervise you in that work. Okay? The more people you have like John into the business, the less direct supervision you have to have. In other words, John doesn't have to be directly supervised. He's licensed. only unlicensed people have to be directly supervised. So if we get landscape construction professionals that are licensed in the technical area, they directly supervise all the people that are unlicensed. They don't require any direct supervision on their own. What this bill does is then says, if John was just a technical person and wanted to own a landscape contracting business, because that's a second license in our system, then John would have to take the course and pass the laws and rules and business practice section of the exam. Then he could own a business. He would be directly supervising unlicensed people. He could hire you, if you were licensed as a technical person, to directly supervise other unlicensed people. So that direct supervision gets carried down through the business with the more licensed individuals that you have. So if you have 100 employees out there and you only have one licensed landscape construction professional, it's pretty hard to directly supervise all those people. So those people, the idea is that you could have more licensed landscape construction professionals that were directly supervising that work. Did that answer your question?
So this actually sounds to me like you're easing off on
yes.
regulation, not adding more to.
That's correct.
Well, and one point that I think should be made also is that you're opening up other avenues besides the exclusively the test to attain that license. So CLT is a very hands-on test that you go through in July when OLCA offers it. And you pass each section, and if that indeed does work out, then having your CLT designation will then qualify you for conceivably getting the CLP license.
So one more clarifying question.
Go ahead.
With this measure, are we changing at all? I understand what we're changing about the testing aspect. Are we changing at all what a licensed person may do or is qualified to do?
What the board has decided to do in this case is the phases will remain the same. The board is also working with a textbook writer, to get all the information about landscape construction into one manual. Today it's pretty broad and pretty hard to obtain all the information, so the board is working to get that all put together. You are not decreasing or increasing what a landscape construction professional can do. So we're trying to make it easier for them to get a license. That's the whole purpose of this bill.
But not so that you can require more licenses.
No.
Within a business.
No, we're not asking anything about the business.
That's
has to
the
have.
Essence of what I'm getting at. Does a company like Grants Landscape that has a licensed contracting professional, I just don't know if I'm getting the word right, the term right, a licensed contract professional.
Construction professional.
Construction professional, thank you. On staff, are they going to in any way be required to have filtered down through their ranks more of these people? But the only way to require them to have more of these people is to make it easier to get that by removing the business piece of the exam.
So, Senator Edwards, Chair Beyer. The idea is, like, take grants, for instance. I don't know what their structure is.
I don't really know either.
Let's take another company that has, say they have 100 employees, and they have one licensed landscape construction professional. The way the statute is written today is that if you're an unlicensed employee, you, in order to do landscaping work, you have to be directly supervised by that landscape construction professional. Now, we have that in the statute. And so we have written rules around what that means, and that means they do not have to be on the job site all the time, but the employee at least has to have a certain amount of instruction from that landscape construction professional and has to know who that landscape construction professional is and be able to contact that person. That's the requirement. Well, if you have 100 employees out there, it's difficult to have one person directly supervise those people. So the idea is that a lot of the industry has been hesitant to allow more licensed landscape construction professionals because they're afraid there's going to be competition. We're removing that aspect by saying if you just have the technical parts of this, right, you will get a license, you can directly supervise, it relieves the burden off of one, it makes more licensed people available. It's not a requirement. If they can directly supervise and perform that function, it's not a requirement. But it allows for these licensed people that are doing this work can demonstrate their competency through the test or through other certifications that if they don't speak English as well, they can demonstrate it hands-on, they're competent to do it, they should be allowed to get a license. That's what we're after.
Thank you for indulging me in
no
more questions.
No problem. Happy.
More?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Atkins.
What is this whole rigmarole cost? What does it cost? How much if somebody wants to go take this exam? What's it cost?
The exam costs, if you go for a sitting of the exam will cost you $65 for the first section and $10 for each additional section that you take. So if you take seven sections, it'll cost you $125.
And where does that money go?
It goes to the testing company that we have contracted to administer our exam. It doesn't go to the board.
How much money does that testing company make each year?
Well, they probably give 400 and 500 exams during the year. But one of the things I want to point out to Senator Atkinson on this is we have contracted with this company because of the psychometric review they do of the exam. They're constantly reviewing the exam to see if the questions are relevant, see how they are being performed in the industry, and they pay for all of the subject matter experts to come together and review the exam and write the questions.
More?
I lost your committee.
All righty, we will close the public hearing on... I'm sorry, I should ask first, is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this? Senate Bill, or House Bill 2158. Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing then, and dare I open the work session.
Okay. Can I ask a question?
We're starting here. How many employees are in the agency?
We have five and a half.
How many inspectors?
We have one and a half that are employed, and we have five contract investigators throughout the state.
And, Mr. Chair, the your investigators, how do they, what do? Drive around looking in neighborhoods, or are they paid on a bounty, or how? Talk to me about how those guys work.
So our employed investigators, most of our investigations are done by referrals from the industry. The industry is pretty vigilant about when they see landscaping work being performed on a job site, they will call the office. We will give that to our lead investigator, and he will either dispatch a contract investigator to the site, or if it's within our area where that investigator lives, we'll go to the job site and investigate what's going on at the job site.
How much, Mr. Chair, if I follow up, how much do the your contract investigators, do they get paid an hourly wage? Or
no, they're under contract with us, so they get paid a set fee based upon whether it is a dispatched investigation, which is the office. If the office receives a call, then we can call them and ask them to go to the job site. Since their contract, they get to decide whether they can go or not. We pay them $125 to go investigate. If they're in an area and they see other landscaping work being done, they can do what we call a site check, and we pay them $25 for one of those.
I think I'm just going to set it over.
So do they do these these site checks on their own? Can they just go out or they have to be dispatched?
They do not have to be dispatched for a site check. If they see some landscaping work being done, they have the authority to investigate that.
And they're empowered because they're on contract to do that at any time. They're empowered as an agent of the state of some kind, have some sort of authority.
All they do is give us a report. They do not have any fining capacity or anything like that. It all comes back to the board.
But so, Mr. Chair, they walk onto somebody's private property, show some sort of ID to somebody, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you, because some guy's putting in some sod. I mean, so under what authority, I guess, do they operate?
The board has authority in the statute to investigate any kind of landscaping work that's going on. Okay, and so the board hires contracts with investigators. They do not have a identification badge from us or anything like that. They are private investigators, licensed private investigators. And we allow them to go to a job site if they've been dispatched. They only go onto the sidewalk, see what's happening, look at it. If they'll have somebody come out and talk to them, they will talk to them and find out what's going on the job site and report back to us.
So as a private investigator, they have to stay in a public property?
As a private investigator, they cannot trespass.
Interesting. Okay, thank you.
I think we're going to set this one over and give you, some members clearly have some doubts about this, and you might want to visit it a little bit.
Okay.
Okay.
Sure.
So we will, I already closed the public hearing, so we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2078. Thank you, gentlemen.
House Bill 2078 repeals certain statutes regarding fire escapes and other fire safety requirements. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Whenever you're ready.
Chair Byron, members of the committee, my name is Stacy Warner. I'm an Assistant Chief Deputy State Farm Marshal with the Office of State Farm Marshal. House Bill 2078 was developed in collaboration with stakeholders from Oregon's fire and building officials. Its purpose is to streamline ORS Chapter 479, Protection of Buildings from Fire, Electrical Safety Law, by rescinding portions of the statute that are outdated, redundant, or in conflict with the state's adopted building and fire codes. The portions of the statute this bill proposes to repeal are no longer necessary, as they're now more correctly addressed in the state adopted codes. This bill is supported by consensus by the Joint Fire Service Legislative Committee, which includes the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, Oregon Fire District Directors Association, Oregon Fire Marshals Association, Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association, the Oregon State Firefighters Council, the Oregon Fire Medical Administrators Association, and the League of Oregon Cities. I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, so questions.
Now,
this is just this sounds to me like a technical cleanup bill.
It's just housekeeping.
Reducing things. Reducing regulations. We're on a roll today.
Mr. Chair, we had one earlier today that was characterized as perhaps the driest bill of the session, and it didn't make it past the first day.
Just point out again, I believe Stacy said this reduces regulations.
That's what I thought the last one did.
Seriously, are there questions?
No.
No questions? Okay. Thank you, Stacey. That's all I have signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2078? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing. We will open a work session on 2078. Senator Rudd, would you like to move 2078?
Sure. I'll move House Bill 2078 to the floor with a due-pass recommendation.
Senator Girard has moved House Bill 2078 to the floor with a due-pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion?
Oh, we love it.
You love it?
I think it's fantastic.
No discussion? Is there any opposition?
Best bill here today.
Well, that's, I think he should carry.
Yeah, he's asking for it, isn't he?
He is.
House Bill 2078 is moved to the Senate floor by unanimous support of the committee.
Senator Burdick excused. We are closed work session on House Bill 2078.
Carry.
Who would like to carry? Oh, you guys. I'll do it.
Well, I was going to do it because it's so easy.
Senator Burdick, would you like to hear back? Would you like to vote on 2078?
Yes.
Everybody else vote yet? Well,
is this a good bill?
Oh,
yes,
it's
an excellent bill.
Trust us.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
Senator Burdick, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
Senator Burdick votes aye. Record that, please. Anything else to come before the committee today? God, I hope not. We are adjourned.